it's not these dark times. We have a notion that it's dark times because we have filtered out anything positive, right? Because of the way the news media works and the way social media works, unless we're consciously curating what we see, we will believe we're in these dark times, but we are not. We have, believe it or not, less wars going on in the world. That's better than ever before. Fewer children are dying before the age of 4. Fewer mothers are dying in childbirth. More people have access to education. More women have access to education than ever before. I mean, yes, there are pockets of not goodness in the world, but that's like throwing out the entirety of a casserole because one corner is burnt.
Hello and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast, where you're going to hear from innovators around the world who are solving some of our biggest problems, and they still think the future is bright. And today's episode is pretty special. I'm the host and a co-founder of the Goodness Exchange, and today I'm interviewing my co-founder, Liesl Ulrich Verderber. Liesl is an amazing woman. She is a Harvard grad, but she comes from really ordinary people roots. She grew up on a farm in northern Vermont and has roots in Illinois on another farm. She was fortunate enough to travel the world, 30 countries, before she was age 25. So she's got this really humble beginnings, but this major worldly outlook. And that combination has enabled her to do some remarkable things. Since 2015, she has built our enormous website called the Goodness Exchange. And we have been great students of all the positive news that's happening in the world. We've both tuned our algorithms to know that that's all we're going to give our attention to. And so we see so much about what's right with the world. Today in our conversation, we're going to share some tips and tricks and insights that we've had over the last 10 years, and we're going to help you see the kind of world that's worth getting excited about, just like we do. So Liesl, let's make sure and make this a conversation where people feel like they can walk away with a boatload of new ways to start 2024 and see the world we really wish was out there. I think you and I both know that a more balanced worldview is life-changing.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Also, I should say we share a last name because Linda is my mom. So I don't think we mentioned that in the intro.
Did I forget that?
A key part of it.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so Liesl comes by her worldview about possibility and positivity. Naturally, her father and I have been believers in humanity. We're holding out hope all our lives, despite some challenges when we were young. And Liesl is the oldest of our three children. And she could have really been doing anything she wanted in the world for the last 10 years. And yet she has given her time, energy, and skill to this project of making the world a better place and expanding what people know about that version of reality. So Liesl, I've got a list of questions over here for us to just loosely talk about. We're going to share a lot of things with folks. Let's get started on this conversation about, I think that we're in this time when we need to give people more practical advice than think positive. Talk to us. Because that's not what you and I are doing. If I need to say, if you go visit the Goodness Exchange and our articles there, we're not talking about puppies in mailbox sort of stuff. Give us kind of a rundown of how you perceive the mission that we're on over there at the Goodness Exchange.
Yeah. So at the Goodness Exchange, we are really talking about positive news that matters, right? This kind of positive news that is actually solving a world's problem. Listen, I have a rescue dog, love puppies, big fan of that. But I think what people are looking for in the world are actual solutions to the world's problems. I think we all know how it feels to watch a really terrible newscast. And then at the end, they throw in that like 4 minutes or like 2 minutes of like, and here's a positive thing that's going on in the world. And it just doesn't give you a lasting feeling that the world's going to be okay. And so for us, it's really critical for us to create positive news that feels like the world's going to be okay at the end, because we're shining a spotlight on people who are really making a tangible impact in the world. And I think it's important, A, to celebrate them because they're not getting the news time that they deserve. And B, I think it just allows us to not only know inside, okay, somebody's handling this problem with rainforest deforestation, but also then be able to share those stories with other people. So you start to create this sort of outward spiral of people knowing that there is solid, positive news in the world.
And, you know, that's really what gets us inspired to go find our own way, what we're uniquely built to contribute, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, teaching Taekwondo, we've written an interview to a 15-year-old who taught Taekwondo to folks in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And it changed people's lives. I mean, that's what a 15-year-old can do in this world. All the way from there to, as you mentioned, Topher White, who's figured out a way to save all the remaining rainforests in the world using old cell phones that most of us have in a drawer. So there's a wide spectrum there, places that we can all participate. But first, we have to feel like it's worth it and it can be done.
Right, right. And I think that it comes from, you know, I think it's really important for people to know that positive news isn't just fluffy. It's not just something that I think, let me back it up and say, I think we put this importance on negative news because we think it's important, right? It's important to stay informed. It's important, even though I'm feeling a lot of pain and I'm not even able to process my emotions, I have to feel the world's pain. But I think the opposite is also true. And I think it is more important, right? Like, when we are exposed to positive news, there's actually a Harvard study done by a Harvard professor that looked at the way that people in the workplace felt when they were exposed to positive news. And she found that with just like between 90 seconds and 4 minutes of exposure to positive news, people were 32% less anxious, 12% more grateful, and 18% more optimistic. So, I mean, those are kind of big feelings that are important to have, because sure, we can go through the world depressed and angry about the world and all those kind of things, but that doesn't put us in any position to fix any of the problems that are happening, right? So we have to be optimistic. We can't be anxious, and we have to be feeling a sense of gratitude if we want to be working from a place of, okay, how do we fix the future? How do we make the future better? We really have to be in a better headspace. And so positive news, like we've said, isn't just this kind of like little lollipop moment. It's not rose-colored glasses. It's changing the way we look at the world, and it's making us more innovative. It can make us be more solutions oriented, and it allows us to commune with each other in a different way than just communing and griping over the badness in the world, right?
Yeah. I think we all know and love the rare person in our lives who always seems to be able to find the bright side. Now, that sounds all Pollyanna, but we all know someone, and you know through our lives, Liesl, I've called those people the joyful ones. Mm-hmm. They're the people who are got the big tank of bug spray on their back, and they're still singing while they're spraying the foliage for mosquitoes before the big graduation party or wedding, right?
Right.
They're the ones that can be cleaning up, you know, the mouse poo in the basement and still have a spring in their step and think something positive is going on.
Right, right.
So we're looking for the joyful ones in our life in these dark times. And they're usually people who can...
Can I interject? Ahead. I don't know that it is dark times. It's not these dark times. I
think okay.
That's like the opposite of what we're trying to say, really, because it's not these dark times. We have a notion that it's dark times because we have filtered out anything positive, right? Because of the way our news media works and the way social media works, unless we're consciously curating what we see, we will believe we're in these dark times, but we are not. We have, believe it or not, less wars going on in the world than ever before. I know that that's a hard thing to understand when there are two very prominent wars going on in the world right now, but that's better than ever before. Fewer children are dying before the age of 4. Fewer mothers are dying in childbirth. More people have access to education. More women have access to education than ever before. I mean, yes, there are pockets of not goodness in the world, but that's like throwing out the entirety of a casserole because one corner is burnt. That's just a silly thing to do, right? We can't throw out the entirety of what today is because one corner is not perfect. Can we aspire to make that corner perfect and do better? And we should. Oh, yes, of course. But I think overall, we're in an arc of positivity in the very, 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 very long arc of time.
Yes. Oh, thank you for that correction. That is such, I was just kind of buying into the narrative.
Well, it's easy to, right? I mean, this is a great example, right? It's really easy. Like, our job is positive news, and yet it is so easy to find ourselves saying those kind of things, right? It's an offhand comment. And I think the big thing is all of these little offhand comments, you know, they build up to a worldview, right? So it's really the smallest pebbles, the smallest parts of how we talk about and think about the world that all add up into thinking that we are looking at an insurmountably large wall, right? When in reality, it's made of pebbles or it's very small.
Now, there's some brain science to this, which you and I both like to talk about. You know, this interview, we want to open people's minds to the fact that it's natural for us to seek out bad news. Like, as much as we try and discipline ourselves, there's a part of our brain that hasn't had an upgrade. I've talked to some neuroscientists about this. More than a few have reminded me that there's a part of our brain that hasn't had an upgrade in 35,000 years. So the fact is that if you and I are sitting here, if anybody's listening to this, it's because their ancestors were actually quite good at bad news. They lived to tell about it. 35,000 years ago, you sat around the campfire and told about where the good berries were. The important part was not where the good berries were. The important part was, and somebody saw a saber-toothed tiger up there last week, right?
Right.
The people who were good at bad news for most of human history, when things are rough, man, there's a lot of danger in everyday life. Those are the people that survive. But here we sit in a time, as you just pointed out, that by statistics is better than all of human history. And yet we can't see it because our brains are looking for danger and disorder.
Yeah. And I think, too, a really important thing to note is that there's so many more of us than ever before, right? Our brains were not made for this many types of human connection, right? I think there's a study done where like we're supposed to, our bands of groups, right? We're about 15 to 30 people or something like that. And now our social circles are hundreds of people, right? Yeah. And so it's amazing that we're doing as well as we are when we're stacked on top of each other as much as we are, yeah, right? When we've created cultures that are different than one another and ideologies about religion and how we'd run politics and how we use money. And I mean, think of all of the ways that all of us are different. It is a wonder that we are here today and that we, of course, we're going to have conversations about there's so much difference between this group and that group. And it seems insurmountable. Well, I think we're doing pretty, pretty good for the billions of people that are on this planet and living in an incredibly interconnected world. I think that's an incredible thing for us to acknowledge, pat ourselves on the back, and then again, always work towards saying we got to keep doing better. But I think that that's something that I think we should really celebrate and cherish is how well we are doing sometimes.
Yeah, you know, through this whole interview, I want to share with people our experiences on what we've learned about the world and perspective from all these innovators that we've written and interviewed. And I've learned, for one, Dr. David Cooperator, who is a world-renowned innovator who's counseled presidents, the Dalai Lama, and Nobel Prize winners. David Cooperator champions a concept called appreciative inquiry. And that's where we pause and we get more thoughtful about what comes out of our mouth, what kind of intention we're assuming in the other, what kind of question we ask, protecting the other person's dignity. And one of the things I love about what we've seen on the internet, what comes to us through our algorithms, because we're always looking for goodness and progress, is over there on my wall. I wish I could, it was easy for me to turn this around, but you know, so much of the media focuses on our differences, but David Cooperator's big insight is that we could be talking about what we all want more of, not what we all want less of. Because if we talk about what we all want more of, turns out there's a lot that we have in common. We want to be able to walk down the street safely. We want to be able to have clean air. We want to have drinking water that our kids are safe drinking. There's so much that we want more of, but we seem to get trapped because of the way our brains work in this downward spiral of what we want less of. So you do public speaking and you're consulting with businesses about this concept of why seeking positive news is important.
I think this is really critical for a couple of reasons. I think one, it points to the importance of positive news, right? It gives us this ability to think forward, to think into the future, right? It shifts our mindset from being negative and being in that downward spiral, like you were saying before with David Cooperrider's work, getting stuck in nothing can be fixed, what are the problems, to think, being able to think more in terms of possibility, right? To be able to think more broadly, to live with less stress, right? To be able to think with more clarity, think with more optimism, problem solve with less anxiety, right? We need to be in the right mindset in order to be thinking into the future and be thinking excitedly mm-hmm. about what's going to happen, you know, what we're innovating towards, right? And I think we're always innovating yeah. towards better. You know, we are never in a state of perfect, but we can always be innovating towards better. And if we get stuck in negativity, we're not innovating towards better. We're getting stuck in where we currently are now. And if we're feeling upset about it, mm-hmm. then yeah, that's a push, an emotional push in yeah. the right direction to do something different.
So a lot of what you just said could be applied to business and our working lives, but wow, I'm sure it matters. That kind of a more positive attitude, knowing more about the world, knowing that there are things that are possible that you wouldn't imagine. I'm sure that worked to improve our relationships with our 14-year-old.
Right.
Or our, you know, a coworker who's just impossible to work with. I think our family life and all the division that we're seeing in families, that's probably impacted by a more expansive view of what's possible.
Well, yeah, I think with anything we do, right? If we dwell in a space of, oh, things will never get better, I don't see a way out, right? If we're stuck there, we're going to find ourselves repeatedly going forward, doing the same things over and over and over again, right? If we want to change our relationship with our, you know, uncle, or we want to change our relationship with our work, well, we have to put in some conscious work there to say, okay, what is making me unhappy? And then I think one of the big things that a lot of people don't realize is the way that these sort of micro worries start to add up. And then it's like being in a loud room, right? If we're in a loud room, right, if someone slowly starts turning up the volume in a room, suddenly you're actually in a super loud room, but you're not hearing it anymore. But all of a sudden you're maybe angrier. You're probably more irritable. I know this is a thing. I've heard it, like, you know, when someone's like drilling in the background, or your neighbor, you know, they're doing construction in the apartment next to you. You don't realize that that's grating on you. And that's what happens when we're constantly absorbing negative news all day long, or the negativity of the media, or finding ourselves comparing our lives to the other people on social media, whatever it is, right? These little things that make us feel negative, that all of a sudden we're carrying around that feeling with us all of the time. And then when our kid does something annoying, or our dog does something annoying, or your partner does something annoying, your response to them is completely different than it would have been if you were in a quiet room, or you didn't have those annoyances around you all the time, right? So I think that's something important for us to understand, really, is the way in which all these little stressors add up and then impact the way that we react to everything in our lives.
Yeah. I do a lot of public speaking, and I always use the line, you know, if you've got a constant steady stream throughout your day of negativity, it's like trying to think straight in a room where the fire alarm is blaring.
Yes.
That's it. I know we've all been in that moment when we're in a room at a conference or wherever, and the fire alarm's blaring. You just can't try to do what you want to do. Another example is, you know, trying to cook with a squirming, screaming toddler in your arm. You're not going to be able to make the same dinner. So once we realize this, we can move on to a better life. And that's what I want to spend a lot of this interview talking about. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about autopilot first, because you have a great wrap that you like to share with people about education and the failure in our education system to get us all digitally savvy and get us literate about how the internet works. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So I think this goes back to something we were chatting about earlier, right? Is this idea that technology continues to evolve. Like we're dealing with this 35,000 year old software, but we keep inventing in our brain, right? But we keep inventing new technologies. And every single technology that gets invented, people think the world's going to fall apart. When the printing press came out, I love this. Thank you to my sister for telling me this story. When the printing press came out, people were really upset about it. They thought that people were going to print all kinds of dumb stuff, that the world was going to become dumber as a result of so much literature that wasn't highfalutin being published and brought to the masses. Well, you know, I think we all survived, and I'm guessing our literacy, or I know our literacy rates across the world are up higher, and people's quality of life is higher as a result, right? So when we look at the internet, it's sort of the same thing. And I am in this funny space in my age where I was taught what the Dewey Decimal System was and how to walk into a library and go, know that this is the fiction section, this is the research section, this is where the encyclopedias are, and I'm not going to the fiction section or the opinion section in order to write my paper about, you know, ancient Egypt, right? I'm not going to the books that are, you know, stories that someone's made up, you know, fiction, historical fiction, to write my paper. I have to go to the research section. But what I think is sort of happening right now, and what's happened to, of course, the internet, also when I was growing up, the internet was around. It was a Wild West. Parents didn't know how to teach anybody. Teachers, no adult knew what was going on. The kids were making the rules. The teenagers were making the rules. So any space where the teenagers are making the rules is a questionable space. And so what we're seeing now is this problem of young people have not been taught the literacy, you know, digital literacy, the way that we were taught how to walk into a library and know where to get information from, right? People don't know, young people, adults don't know that anything that you see on the internet isn't true. People don't realize that a blog is an opinion. It's not necessarily, you know, journalism. We have a really hard time understanding the difference between journalism and opinion. And that's been conflated also on the TV. You watch all these pundits. That's usually not news. That's opinion. That's one person's opinion, their understanding of the world. That is not objective truth. And so, but a lot of people don't know that. And so I think it's really important going forward. And there are some states, I think Michigan is one of them, that are instituting mandatory digital literacy classes, right? So people can understand, you know, Wikipedia, not a great source. It's not a first-hand source. It's actually a lot of opinions put together. It's not fact-checked. But something like the New York Times would be more fact-checked, not the opinion section, but, you know, the journalism, right? So we have to, the same way we once had to learn how to use the library and the Dewey Decimal System and the card system, we now have to do that with the internet. And I think it's vital because we are sponges. Humans are sponges. We want to learn. We're curious. Young people are curious. Adults are curious. And if we don't know, if we're not satiating our curiosity in a way that helps us define truth from opinion, from fiction, then we're going to find ourselves in sort of this confused place where a lot of us are, where we don't know what to believe. And that creates a distrust in all information that can be very, very dangerous.
Okay. So we each have our own tricks on how we decide what to give our attention to on the internet. And one of my questions on down, but we might as well bring it up, was, you know, how do you know what's true? So you and I have developed really, really, as I mentioned before, amazing algorithms that send us good news just by virtue of the relentlessness that we've been looking for it. And truthful good news. Liesl and I, we should say that for the Goodness Exchange, since day one, we do our homework. Mm-hmm. We don't just pluck things off the internet and repeat them or pass them on. We do a ton of homework to make sure that what we're writing about is true and it comes from seriously credible sources. Okay, so I'll offer people a few tips that I use to know who to give my attention to on the internet, and then I'll let you talk about how yours is. So my first thing is I really am only giving my attention to people who are thoughtful, measured, and helpful these days. That's it. If you have to wave your hands and shout at me and point and carry on, I'm wondering if you have a lot of real essence or substance to say. You know, there's that old adage that, you know, if you can't explain it in about 2 minutes, then you probably don't understand it yourself. And I really watch the people who are trying to entice me to come to the same conclusion that they are by using a lot of emotion. So when somebody starts going towards fear, telling me all kinds of things to get me afraid, and then I'll believe them or I'll agree with them, boom, I'm out. Because if you got to use fear, it's probably because you don't have facts. So that's my one thing. I'll even share with people, I don't watch the TV very much, but TV news is a thing, or even, well, in any kind of media where you're watching somebody on a screen, try this. Turn down the sound entirely and see if you can still tell that this person is trying to make you angry, outraged, sad, whatever. If you can tell without even hearing their words by their body language and facial expression, then they are trying to convince you to come over to their way of thinking and not remain open. So those are two of my tricks. I really think about what people, a third one is agenda. I really think about what the person's deeper truth is. Somebody may be talking to me about this and that, but what's their deeper truth? Are they trying to sell me to get me to buy something? Are they trying to get me to join some group they've got? Like, if there's a deeper truth involved in somebody reporting the news to me, I'm out. So those are my three tips. What about you?
So I think my space that I come from is a lot on like YouTube, right? I think YouTube can be a really dangerous place to fall down rabbit holes. There's not a lot of really good guards on, okay, I'm going to watch this video and then I fall down this video and then I fall down this video. And sometimes that can lead us into places that are just not truthful. So I think for me, I like to make sure that the where I'm getting my news or my understanding about the world from is coming from a media source that doesn't have a singularly partisan agenda. I think it's important that they also are based in science and in fact. I think that for me, determining that comes a lot down to what you were saying with the agenda piece is also who are they serving, right? If you know that that individual is serving a very particular population, take that with a grain of salt. I'm not saying stop listening to your favorite, you know, podcaster or watching your favorite YouTuber, but understand that they are people. They're not monoliths of fact. That critique is good, right? Critique, I think, is becoming, you should be able to critique almost anything that you're watching. That's helpful for your brain. So that is important. And I think also, you know, there has been a distrust in large media organizations, but, you know, a lot of the people that I watch at the end, they'll have a bunch of cited sources, or the podcast that I listen to, they'll say, you know, here are my cited sources for what I've said, or it's down in the description box or what have you. So I really like to trust individuals and organizations that are doing multifaceted fact-checking. And a really good way to know whether that's happening or not is to look and see whether or not at the end of the video or down in the description box, if they've got their references. I'm a big fan of references because we've got to be able to track down the sources of what people are saying and be able to take any firsthand accounts that we're getting with a grain of salt. I think this is a really important thing, is that every single person has an agenda and that no singular person is right. I think this is where we fall into a really a downward spiral, is when we believe one news organization or one individual is correct in what they're saying. If there's a lot of dissent around what they're saying, then maybe the answer is actually somewhere in the middle, right? If people are saying, hey, that seems wacky to me, even if I think it's true, if someone's saying, hey, I think that sounds a little wacky, maybe go take a look at what the opposite group is saying, or try and expose yourself to something that's broader. For me, it's really about exposing yourself to a broad range of things, understanding that everyone is an individual and that they're going to have their own opinions, and you have to absorb from many different places in order to be properly educated about what's going on.
Yeah, I will turn people on to an interview I did for this podcast with Nat Geo photographer, an amazing man, DeWitt Jones. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. He has a wonderful rap about there being more than one right answer. And that is a fundamental part of the equation here. I have to say, I tune out on people who make a really big, complicated problem sound too simple. Like, they're so exasperated about why the world just doesn't go do this and then it would all be fixed. That to me is such a red flag, because there are complicated problems because they are complicated. And for anybody who tries to oversimplify as if there was one great swath brushstroke that would just make a problem go away, that almost calls us to use our critical thinking and go find another source.
And it really is about critical thinking, right? I think there's a lot of celebrity interviewers, and I think there's a lot of celebrity newscasters. Generally, it's, you know, I think where we get really into a dangerous position, especially in independent media, I think independent media is very important, but it also can be a dangerous place where there's not a lot of rails on fact checking. So people are getting interviewed and the interviewees are saying whatever they believe to be true. And then the interviewer isn't putting guide rails or stopping them when they're saying things that are objectively untrue, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's on us as consumers to say, oh, I should probably go fact check that 3-hour long interview I just listened to. Right. Well, that's a dangerous place to be, right? I think we need to be more critical. Yes, that's what we need to do. But we also need to understand the difference between what is news and what is truth and fact, and what is a rambling interview between two people, right? Like, I hope that you, right, in entertainment, right? Yes, like, it. I hope that you take some lovely pieces from listening to this interview, but, you know, we're talking off the cuff, and generally off the cuff is not long thought out, drawn out, you know, I'm pulling my research and all that kind of stuff. And when we try and say statistics, we'll then link you to where we got them. But that's really important, is that if you're listening to something that's a conversation between two people, just because it's a conversation between two people does not make it objective truth. And it very often in those longer form interviews, they're not getting fact checked throughout the entire thing. So that's just something to be highly aware of when we're, mm-hmm. you know, taking things as truth.
Okay. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, Liesl and I are going to talk about some things that we've learned about the internet, how it works with our brains, how it works so that we can be a part of using the internet in a whole new way. I personally believe that we've reached the end of the whatever phase of the internet. I mean, the internet is merely a human creation, like satellite technology and the cotton gin and the printing press. It's just a human creation. And with almost every human innovation, we reach a point where it needs to be reimagined because it's not safe anymore. The steam engine is a great example of that. It changed the world, but many people were eventually dying because the steam engine was such an unsafe design from the beginning. So the same is with the internet. We can reimagine its role in our lives and make it the most tremendous force of positive progress. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk about that. Thanks. You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new, more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness. Okay, we're back with my co-founder, Liesl Ulrich Verderber. She's also my daughter, an amazing woman in technology and communication and journalism. She is the co-founder of the Goodness Exchange with me, and I am delighted to have her on this podcast to share with us what she is taking away from this wild experience that she and I have had in literally curating the internet for good news. And not puppies and mailboxes stuff, but the fact that dogs can smell breast cancer in stage two. And we're going to let the puppies and mailboxes stuff be done by other good news websites, but we're going to turn people on to amazing insights and innovation that just aren't being celebrated enough. So in that light, Liesl, I want us to talk about something major that we've learned. So we all do it. We've all seen it done. I don't personally do it because I have had a major revelation on this, but we all know what it looks like to sit with someone or do this ourselves where we're scrolling, clicking for just an instant and clicking away, scrolling. Okay. That is a practice that I don't do anymore because one day I realized our click is a vote. This is a really big statement. Every click you make is a vote. Liesl and I started out ordinary people before we launched this journey to curate the internet for goodness and progress. And I think we knew that our click was a vote, but I don't think we acted like we knew it. So talk to me about this agency that we all have, about how the internet is constructed to actually float things other than goodness and progress to the top.
Yeah. So I think one of the most important things that we can do is stop saying the algorithm like is terrible and the algorithm is built to feed us bad things. I don't think it's very helpful to keep, it's like talking about it's like a boogeyman, right? You can blame everything on it, but that isn't what's happening. So in order to understand the algorithm better, we have to understand what it was built to do, right? Algorithms, we use them all the time, was built to serve us what we want. Our brains use an algorithm every day when we decide what to put on our bodies. We say, do I need to be comfortable? What's the weather outside? What's my favorite color, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it uses that algorithm to help us pick the right pants and shirt for the day. The same thing is happening on any of the algorithms that are on our social media. These algorithms are simply built in order to show us the things that we want to see, right? I mean, there is something to be said for these algorithms also are trying to keep us, you know, on the platform. We have to know that. That's how any organization makes its revenue, is getting you in the door and keeping you there. But we have to understand that beyond that, we are building what gets sent our way. So every click that we make, every moment that we pause on something kind of out of morbid curiosity, every profile that we head down and like and follow, that tells the algorithm to serve us more of it. And it can happen incredibly quickly. A great example, this Christmas, I picked up knitting again. So I was looking at a lot of knitting content. Now, every single thing that isn't a friend of mine is knitting content, right? Before, I think it was hiking content, right? Because yeah. I was kind of in a hiking mood. So you can see, you can practice. Go on your favorite social media platform and dive down a rabbit hole of something, and you'll see that the algorithm will start to serve you more of that. So with that in mind, it's really on us then to start curating the way that the algorithms serve us. And I think a big thing in that is, like Linda was saying, Mom was saying, was that our click is a vote, right? So anything that we click on, we're going to get more of. And anything we click on will be produced more. This is a really big thing. I don't think we understand quite so much the impact we have on what gets made in the world. And the way that content gets made, the way a YouTuber decides what to make, is based on what people watched most last. The way that a news media outlet frames up its headline is based on what got the most clicks last time. So if they find that the scary, scary headline is getting the most clicks, because if they get clicks, then they get views on the ads and they get to say they had X amount of visitors. So that gets them more ad revenue, right? They have to keep their doors open. And that's how it works, is they are trying to get people to come to their platform. They being anybody that has a platform. I hate using the big spooky they and not putting in who it is. So media creators are trying to get you into the door, and they are looking at everything from the image that they choose to the title that they choose to the headline. All of this stuff matters to them. And so we have to be cognizant of if we want more of something, if we want there to be less acrimony in the headlines that are happening all the time, then don't click on acrimonious headlines. If you want more content that is positive, that is helpful and wonderful, you know, click on that. And I think, and also be, and also say it. I don't think that there's anything bad in calling out when an organization feels like it's using fear tactics on you. Let them know that that's not okay. I have to say, we are becoming more and more sensitive to that on social media. I'm finding that we're just saying, hey, this is, behavior is not okay. We don't want to come here. We don't want anymore to have our fear senses spiked or to feel angry at our neighbor. And people are kind of policing themselves and other people in wonderful ways. And so I think there is space to change. We have to tell people when we want change, and we have to vote with our feet, vote with our fingers, vote with our clicks to tell content creators what we want. And then also tune our algorithms to show us the things that are, you know, better and more fruitful, if that's what we want on our social media. If you don't want that on your social media, that's fine. That's up to you. You're making a choice not to do that, but it's not a big scary algorithm that's forcing you to listen to bad things. It's actually what we're feeding the algorithm that it's going to send us more of that.
Yeah. I always tell people, you will get more of what you click on, period. It's just the way the internet has evolved. And also, I like to remind people that there isn't some, I don't believe, some big, scary, fiendish conspiracy way back when that got us here. We got to remember how this all evolved. Yeah. In 1993, there were a bunch of very excitable engineers running around, and there were 300 websites on the internet, the whole of the internet. And by 2003, there were 40 million. So what happened between 1993 and 2003 was that some kind of an organizing principle had to rise to the top of the internet. And remember, those engineers that were building things in 1993, they had two objectives. They wanted us to connect with each other better, and they wanted us to be able to find information easier. So our attention became the organizing principle of the internet. I do not believe that there was any like fiendish conspiracy about that. They just said, how can we, as it was growing so rampantly, what can become the organizing principle? And that's where we are today. What we give our attention to expands. So when if you're lamenting about all the negativity that you see on the internet, I'm sorry, but there you're causing that.
There isn't just a mystery cabal somewhere saying that we are going to make the world more negative. No. It's us. I mean, there is a responsibility, not a responsibility. We have to be aware. It's our responsibility to be aware that these platforms want us to go visit them and want us to stay.
Yes, because here's the main thing, what we've learned. No one is creating content if we won't click on it. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing that goes away. And I'll tell you how somebody pointed out to me once, that we all know that principle because that's how we run our own social media. If you put a picture of your dog, you and your dog, and you don't get any clicks at all, no likes, no comments, you're never going to put a picture of you and your dog on your social media again. We're all counting the clicks and the likes. And that is on a personal level. And then the institutions that have created the internet and fill it with so much information, they're doing that too. So I really want to help people understand that going to the internet on autopilot is a bad thing for you and what you will see in the world, because your brain is looking for danger and disorder, whether you know it or not. That if you're on autopilot, you're leading with a part of your brain called the amygdala. And that's the part that seeks out danger and disorder. And you will see more and more of that, because those are the little micro clicks, the quick clicks that you're making and then scrolling on. They're something to do with danger and disorder usually there, or morbid curiosity, which is a whole nother whacked environment that you can get served. So we're encouraging people to pay attention to what you're getting your attention to. That's the bottom line. Never, never go to the internet on autopilot. Just pay attention to what you're giving your attention to, and you will see your algorithms improve.
I think with anything, you got to be intentional. It's like when you go to the grocery store without a list, you're going to end up with a bunch of things in your cart and overpaying for things that you didn't need. And maybe sometimes those will be all of the vegetables that the grocery store you said, I'm going to be a healthier version of today. And then sometimes it's not. Sometimes you headed down the snack aisle and you got all the stuff to make cookies. You know, like if you don't go in intentionally, you might end up with some wacky stuff in your cart. And the internet is like the same concept.
So with all that, it would be easy to treat this like if you really go to the grocery store with intention. It's such a good analogy. Might as well stick with it. If you really go to the grocery store with intention to eat healthy, that's it. I'm never buying another thing that's not healthy. That's not good for me. It can kind of feel like you're losing things, like you've lost something, or it feels very restrictive and all that.
Which can, as we know, in diets and on media, lead to a giant backfire. So,
yes,
strong note there.
Exactly. So, one of the things that we encourage people to realize and gravitate towards to make sure that you're getting this sort of a wonderful diet of media in your feeds is to gravitate towards something we're calling the conspiracy of goodness in our times. So the name of the podcast that you'll see, the conspiracy of goodness, splashed around in my TED Talks and in the big website. Talk to us, Liesl, about you do a lot of writing for the Goodness Exchange and you edit all the writing that we do. Talk to us about some stories, just some brief snippets of stuff that's going on in the world that people don't really know about.
Yeah. So I think there's so much. I'm really excited about a recent article that we did, and I think hopefully we'll be able to get a founder on the podcast, is an organization called, the short name is SLOCO, and they're working to rescue urban sloths. Now, I did not think I was like someone that would get excited about urban sloths. And yet here I am now a champion for what they're doing. Because they've just taken this tact. Firstly, I didn't know urban sloths were a problem. And then secondly, I just became so enraptured in the way that they were teaching communities and working with people. That one is really good, and I won't go too far into it. But that was a very, very good one. Go look that one up. I think another one that is vitally important as well is a recent article we did about native bees. And I think we're all running around, and I think this is the most interesting thing from the article, is we're all running around, save the bees, and the poster child is the honeybee, right? Well, honeybees are essentially the chickens of the bee world. They're a domesticated creature that there are lots and lots of them are out in the world. And what we really should be doing is thinking about our native bees that pollinate very specific things, things like beans, things like in the United States, any of the nightshades. There's specific bees that pollinate things like cucumbers and things like tomatoes, right? Peppers. And without them, we don't have very specific foods, but they're not domesticated. So that one is very interesting. I loved that one. That was a favorite one of mind to chat about.
And then about the tiny wooden robot.
Oh, and then that's a very interesting one that, yes, we wrote about too, was this idea of reforestation, right? That it is a lot of labor to go and plant every single tree, but based on the design of a particular seed pod that a tree uses, that's almost shaped like a whirligig. It's kind of shaped like a little helicopter with sort of a point that goes straight down. I'm using my hands here for people that are watching on the audio version of this, and I'm trying to also describe it. So there's a stick, and then there's sort of like two swirls off the top. So it creates a sort of like top effect where it almost creates a corkscrew, and what happens is it corkscrews itself down into the ground, and this
little tiny, like the size of a seed,
yeah, that the seed then gets pushed into the ground. So some scientists took that idea and they made it better, and then they put any seed from a tree that they wanted in it, and what it allows scientists and ecologists to do is sort of spread these seed pods out, or these little whirligig seeds, and then they corkscrew themselves down to the ground, so they have a much higher likelihood of germinating. So we can reforest greater swaths of forests without going in individually, you know, planting little trees. So that one is also another one that I think is pretty neat. And I realize that these are all ecology ones, but there are lots of fascinating stories that are beyond ecology.
Oh, yeah, the artistic ones. How about that article that we did about the quilting bees? The quilting community that's in Alabama.
Geez, Ben,
oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a great article. Story of anybody who's into quilting, or anybody that's been underneath a handmade
art.
Quilt, anybody who's into art or African American history, Black history. I mean, it's an incredible piece about this community that has really taken the useful art of quilting, and over generations and generations created this beautiful artistic, some people call it folk art, but I think it's high art, that in the quilting that is completely unique to this one spot in Alabama. And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story of how we create traditions, how women come together to create community, and how we can celebrate these incredible artists that come from any background. You don't need to have a highfalutin background to be an artist that's making something incredibly powerful and uplifting your community.
So we could go on and on. Liesl and I love to tell stories from the world of things that we're writing about. But what we really need people to understand is this: beginning to care about your worldview is a life changer. It's a game changer. We have to care I'm prone to saying these days, we have to care as much about our worldview as we do our abs. We just do. Because our worldview, that's the position from which we interact with our toddler or our boss or, you know, the person who cuts us off in traffic. If we have a lovely worldview that's expansive and balanced, again, we're not Pollyanna people. We know that there's a very challenging side to humanity in these days. But what we're absolutely certain of is that the part of humanity that is progressing is not rising to the top of the internet. So talk to us about worldview, Liesl. And since it's easiest to start, I can go on and on about how our worldview, we have to be careful about it so that we can raise happy, healthy, cheerful children. But you do a lot of public speaking about how worldview is important in the workplace. Talk about this. Like, if we're driving to work listening to mean and mean-spirited talk radio, we don't push the door open at our workplace and suddenly we're collaborative and lovely to our coworkers. You can't make that transition. Give us your whole spiel on why we should pay attention and start caring about our worldview.
Well, I think this is – our worldview is the one thing that we have, right? I think it is the most important thing that we carry around with us. And I think one of the things that we don't recognize – this goes back to something we talked about earlier, right? Is this way that these sort of micro stressors build up within us and then come out in things like the way that we do work, right? So I think we have to recognize that, A, that there are micro stressors going on all around us, and that we have a limited capacity to deal with them. This was really driven home for me when there was sort of a local tragedy where, like, people were just on edge and it erupted into a violent outburst. And it really struck me that what happened there, by the way, at a basketball game, like an eighth grade basketball game, right? At a middle school basketball game. And I looked at that situation. I said, wow, all of these people were under such stress and tension that there was sort of a kickoff outcome. I wasn't there. I can't report on what was happening. But there was some kickoff moment that led people to such stress and acrimony that it became this violent affair at a kid's basketball game, right?
A kid's basketball game. Yeah.
Right? And I think what that is.
Not among the kids.
Among the parents, it should be said. Yeah. So, but you have to think, what were these people listening to in the car on the way there? What stressors were they undergoing, you know, trying to get the kids in the car and all of that kind of stuff, right? All that stuff is building up. And I think what we're not recognizing is how much stress is going into our ears and we're just absorbing it. We are becoming so inundated with negative news that we'll have it on in the background and we won't even recognize that our brains are absorbing some really horrible stuff, right? And if we don't recognize that there's all that noise going around, we can't recognize that we're all walking around with our boiling point raised just above, you know, blowing our lids, right? Most of us, maybe we used to walk around before that we were so inundated with negativity. We used to walk around with maybe, you know, 50-60% headroom before we blew our lid, right? If you imagine kind of like a graduated cylinder, like, you know, a tube here. We used to walk around with, you know, 50-60% left in the tank before we lost it, before we felt burnt out, before we snapped at somebody. But what has happened is we have sort of absorbed so much negativity that headroom is shrinking more and more by the day. And so now we've got less and less ability to deal with stressors in our lives, right? So if we're constantly got all these sort of little bits, these little annoyances, these loud rooms that we're in, that suddenly we only have a 10% capacity for stress before we blow our lids, then we are walking around in a bad way. And I think it's really important for us to understand what happens when we sort of boil over, when we reach that maximum capacity.
Before you go there, I want to just what you're talking about is these little microaggressions that we're becoming aware of during the
I think microaggression is a different definition, but they're like micro stressors. This is the thing. It's a micro stressor.
So this could be some mean-spirited thing we saw on social media when we woke up in the morning. It could be some talk show that we listen to regularly on the way to work. It could be, you know, tuning into a particular news outlet that just is relentlessly negative about the world and
it could
scary
be our
things.
And then add in your kid doing something right before you're trying to get out the door, or them forgetting to do their homework, or telling you that you have to pack a lunch before because they're on a field trip today. You know, you name it. Any of us are going through a bunch of stressors in our lives. A parent that's injured. Right. And then you add on top of that the negative media.
And the stuff that you chose to engage in. Because this is where I'm all about. I'm all about reminding people that that giving our attention to craziness and negativity on the internet is a choice. And so, yeah, your kids are going to do nutty things at 7:30 in the morning just when you're walking out the door. Yeah, the dog's going to do something terrible in the middle of the kitchen floor. All the things. Those things you can't control. But we can control what we're giving our attention to in the media, social media, news, and so forth. And that, as I understand how you explain it, is what's bringing us closer to the boiling point. And that's sort of by choice if we tune into that stuff all the time.
Right. It's by choice. And I don't even know if it's by choice anymore. It's just by negligence is sort of a bad word for it, but it's what's been on. And so it just stays on. You know, think about how many little kids are just exposed to the news all the time because it's just on in houses, or the talk radio is on in cars. I mean, just like we have to, you know, treat ourselves sometimes like little kids and say, is this an appropriate time for me to be exposing myself to this before I have to go into a hard day's work? Yeah. Listen, it's good to be informed, but you don't have to be informed 100% of the time if it's harming your ability to interact with people in a productive and meaningful way, and if it's harming your ability to, you know, have your livelihood, right? I think that we have to understand that, and I'll go back to this too. When we boil over, you know, we can get into fight, flight, or freeze. Some workplaces, fighting is somewhat okay. You can lose your temper at Kathy, and that's fighting. You can flight. You can leave. Most of us can't leave our jobs immediately, but we can certainly shut down and we can sort of cognitively leave, right? Or we can freeze, right? We can get into this state of self-preservation that I think a lot of us are calling sort of disengagement, right? That freeze and that flight response are disengagement. Mm-hmm. And so if we are disengaged in our work, or if we're people that lead organizations and we're seeing a lot of our employees are disengaged, that's probably not a result of the work but the workplace could be contributing to stressors. We could be not properly supporting people when they walk in the door. I mean, listen, we've all had hard days where someone cut us off. We had a hard day at work. Someone cut us off in traffic. We listened to some horrible news report, and then we walk into our home. And did our attitude change from the car to walking into our house? No. And our homes are our most important places, where the people we love live, where the animals we love live, where the food we love is. Okay. And if we can't even change our attitude about the, you know, reset our attitude and our way of being when we walk into our most important space in the world, our homes, well, then we certainly, as, you know, employers, can't expect people to do that when they walk into our offices or our workplaces. And so it's on us to, A, create workplaces that help to decrease the headspace between sort of our base attitude and boiling over. And I think it's also important as employees to recognize that and maybe request just some quiet time in the morning, maybe a low comms time right in the morning so I can get my head in the right place. As employers, instituting a low comms time, maybe putting out a positive news article now and then. If we go back to what I was talking about before, that study where, you know, 4 minutes of 90 seconds to 4 minutes of positive news decreases anxiety and increases things like optimism and gratitude, why not institute some kind of positive news as a part of the workplace? And will everyone adopt it? No. But I think what we will see is that we will start to see workplaces where people are experiencing more gratitude. I mean, just imagine in your workplace, if people said thank you 12% more, if people, instead of looking at a job that needed doing, were like, this is never going to work. And instead they 18% more of the time, almost 20% of the time, they were like, yeah, we can figure this out. What would that feel like? If 32% of the time people were, you know, you went to meetings and everyone wasn't stressed out. I mean, if a third of the times you went into a meeting, it was a positive and happy place to be. My goodness, that would totally change the way that you do work and the way that work gets done.
I just want to remind people that's going back to that Harvard study, right?
Yeah,
you pulled those numbers. Repeat that one more time because they're big.
Yeah. So this Harvard study looked at people were exposed to positive news in the workplace. And the researcher found that between 90 seconds and 4 minutes of positive news reduced people's anxiety by 32%, increased their optimism by 18%, and increased their feelings of gratitude by 12%. So I think what's really important when we talk about business is not just what's happening, you know, to make things positive for people working in the business, but also I think it's a part of this broader space that we're looking at when we talk about the importance of work to people and also the importance of what workplaces look like to the outside people. And it reminds me, Mom, of something you chat about a lot, which is the gratitude economy. And I think you have like a very nice way of like tying in this whole idea of like your click is a vote. So what you're choosing matters about, you know, how many people are out there doing good in the world in business and in that. And then also too, what I was just talking about with creating business, you know, workplaces that lift people up, you know, that feels like it all ties into the gratitude economy. So I just want to give you a second to chat about that, because I think it just ties in the way in which we can make all of the things that we're talking about sustainable and economically viable into the future. Can you just chat? I mean, I think it would be a great thing to chat about.
It's a great thing to wrap up on for this, because it's something that we all know, we all work with all the time. We're making choices in this gratitude economy. And once you hear it and start seeing it, you can't unsee it. So I'm delighted for us to kind of wrap up there. Okay. So what we've been in for the last, let's say 100 years since the invention of the newspaper and radio, has been in what I call the attention economy. People sold us things, they moved our opinions, all that based on just getting and holding our attention. And we all know that the place that we're in now is that they will do anything to grab and hold our attention. So that's the attention economy. But I think more and more people every day are aware of this game being played with our emotions, and they're turning their backs on it. And I'm thinking that your generation, the Gen Z, is going to get really good at it. But where we're starting is that this thing that I'm calling the gratitude economy is bubbling up. So the gratitude economy is a place where we are all, 69% of us now, self-identify as values-driven consumers. And that went up 17% from 2018 to 2019. Just think about that. Values driven. That means we spend our money, we're consciously thinking about who we're giving our money to when we're doing business. And to give people a really like illustrative story of how that works, I remember during the pandemic, you know, we were all doing the building here and there, and I was going out of the house to get a sheet of plywood. I was going to one of the big box stores. And I just shouted to the house, because during the pandemic, our three kids moved back in with us with their significant others. So our household went from 2 to 8. Very interesting. We can talk about that sometime. But do you remember this day? I shouted, I'm going to blankety blank box store and I'm getting a sheet of plywood. And 7 people yelled, where are you going? And they, when I said, they went, no. All of you shouted, no. You told me to go to a different box store, because that box store had one of the rare black CEOs on the New York Stock Exchange, and the CEO of the other store had some notably bad behavior in the world of politics. Let's just say that much. I went, what? And I'd already done my homework. The sheet of plywood was $10 more at the place with the CEO that you guys respected. But you were like, no, we're not having a sheet of plywood in here that comes from that other place, so don't even try. And I did. I went to the, and I bought the most more expensive piece of plywood. That is the gratitude economy. So the gratitude economy is about who we spend our money with and what we know about them and whether we agree with their values. It also comes down to who will be the trusted advisors in our world. You know, there are a lot of people who drive 45 minutes to an hour to get to a dentist or a hairdresser or a barber or something they just trust implicitly. That is the gratitude economy happening. We're starting to do business online. We want our money to do two things. We want to buy a pair of glasses, but we also want the company we're buying it from to give a pair of glasses to somebody who's less fortunate, right? Mm-hmm. All that is about this economy of goodness that's growing and that more and more people are supporting.
And can I say too that I think, you know, there's all kinds of different ways. Like, I think another great example is, you know, where I buy my sunglasses, right? Like, I changed where I buy my sunglasses because I learned that this company is making sunglasses out of recycled materials as opposed to just using, you know, new plastic. So I think there's lots of ways we can participate. And if we have a certain set of values that we can decide to sort of vote with our purchases or vote with our click or vote with our support, because the ethos of the place fits in with what we want the future to look like, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's important too, is understanding that that's not to say that we're boxed in to like only buy things that sometimes you got to buy the thing on Amazon and sometimes it's the economical choice, right? I think that this is really important, is like sometimes we have to be thoughtful about the economy of what we're doing. Yeah. But at other points, there are going to be some luxury items that we choose to buy, you know, with a particular set of values. And I think it's balancing that, right? It's about progress and not perfection. But if some amount of the time we're choosing where we spend our money or where we spend our time based on the important value systems to us, then that is all a part of the gratitude economy. And again, maybe $10 extra on plywood is something that's, you know, a lot to someone, and maybe that more expensive option changes their choice. But there could be some other thing that we are choosing to buy because it is better for the world or better for the future.
And, you know, we've done a lot of articles and stories on people that have businesses, that have started businesses, for-profit businesses, in this world. Remember the article we did on that company in Seattle that at the beginning of, was it Seattle or Vancouver, at the beginning of the pandemic, they collected all the used chopsticks in the world?
Yeah, that was, I think they're based out of, either it might be Toronto or Vancouver. Can't remember. Yeah. It was one of the major cities in Canada. And yeah, so their business model was to create beautiful furniture out of old chopsticks, right? All these wooden chopsticks were just getting thrown in the garbage. And so they started working with local Chinese restaurants and Japanese restaurants, collecting their used chopsticks, sterilizing them, and then creating these beautiful cutting boards, these beautiful steps, beautiful woodwork out of chopsticks. And I think that's a great example of someone solving a problem. Like, I think we have this idea a lot of the time that like these things can't be profitable or they can't be sustainable. They need, you know, funding donors or what have you. And I think that there are so many organizations that are proving that's just not true. I think there are times for nonprofits. I think there's times for NGOs, but I also think there's times for entrepreneurial spirit and thoughtful entrepreneurship. Like, if we're going to exist in a world the way that it exists, we need more thoughtful entrepreneurship, right? We need more ways of saying, okay, my expertise is X, I'm interested in Y, and the problem I want to solve is Z. And together, that's going to make an equation that creates a profitable business, right? And we've seen so many examples of that being possible that it's hard not to, you know, not to say, oh yes, this could be the way of the future.
I want to make a point of that. We're not just celebrating the business and the ideas of folks that are nonprofits. This little elephant here was given to me by a woman who I've interviewed for the podcast, and we'll put the link to that there. She is the founder of what's called the Elephant Project. And they sell these wonderful little plush toys, and they come with a story. And her business gives 100% of their profits to organizations across the world that are saving elephants. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's happening here is they give you this story with your elephant so that you're literally creating children that are philanthropists from the earliest age that you give this. It's a a system that you engage with these elephants that allows the recipient of the elephant to become a nice little philanthropist and really know where their money's going. Mm. So there are hundreds of examples of that on the Goodness Exchange and then millions out in the real world. And but I that's for the gratitude economy too.
Yeah. And I can say too, I think with the Elephant Project and other things, you know, I think we have to listen to the concerns of the little kids in our lives too. This is so huge. I remember when I learned that a certain large fast food restaurant, you know, they, a lot of their beef came from deforested rainforests at this time. This was probably early 2000s. And I was at that point like a rainforest kid. I don't know when I was little, if it's just me being a 30, almost 31 year old kid, but my age of people, we cared about the rainforest being deforested. And I remember we were on a long road trip and hungry and exhausted. And we pulled over to this fast food restaurant and I was making such a ruckus in the back. I refused to eat because I knew that there was an impact that it was having that I wasn't okay with. I think we got to listen. And my, you guys diligently listened and we went to the other place across the street. I don't know if their beef was any better, but you know, it made me feel good as a little kid that I was doing something important. Yeah. And that's happened in a lot of places. Mom, you talk about when you heard about the anti-littering, I don't want to say propaganda because it was good, but you know, those things that you were learning and how your mom used to just collect the trash and just throw it out the window.
I want to tell that story for people. This is a good, funny story to kind of wrap up on. So I think that what we're talking about here is a really important place to pause this conversation and then pick it up on another episode. But what we're talking about is how we encourage and support the next generation. What we're modeling now is really, really important to what happens next. Okay, the story I have to share is that when I was a little kid, it was perfectly okay to throw your garbage out of a speeding car. I'm telling you, it was what you did. And I remember my mom turning around in her beehive hairdo with her cigarette, because you could smoke in the car back then too. And she'd look at the car and she'd go, "Well, my God, this car is a wreck." And we all knew to just roll down the windows and just start pitching stuff out of the car when we're going 70 miles an hour down the highway. I remember that so clearly. Okay, then, of course, that was happening to everyone in the whole United States and was making quite a mess. So someone put on a created a public service announcement that some of you may remember, where it was just no words said in this public service announcement. It's people driving down the road. It's people driving down the road. And there's a Native American in a big, full, stereotypical Indian headdress on a horse standing right by this highway in like the Great Plains, because you could see the landscape. And all of a sudden, a car whizzes by and throws an entire bag of garbage that just goes plop at the feet of his horse. And he's just still stony, stone-faced, looking at the highway. And then the camera comes in and there's one tear slowly going down his face. And that was the end of it. That was the end of pitching trash outside. That thing, every single child in America knew what they were talking about in that commercial. And it came on Saturday morning cartoons. It came on during football games. We all saw it. And I remember a tipping point where my mom would imply that we should be pitching stuff out the window. And my brother and sister and I would go literally nuts in the back seat to tell her that that was just out of the question. We were not going to do that anymore. And it was children teaching adults what we should be doing next.
We need to be listening to what the next generation is wanting.
Yeah.
The next generation is saying, "Hey, these things are important to me." And sometimes that message is not going to be perfectly said. Sometimes it might be a little more acrimonious than we would want it to be. But I do think that we have to listen to what the next generation is saying and then figure out ways to be helpful, figure out ways that we can respect the wishes of people that we are handing off the planet to. And though that might be hard, we don't get to say what's important to other people necessarily. And if a huge generation of people is saying, "Hey, this is really important to us and this is the place that we want to be in the next few years," it's on us not to be jaded. It's on us not to say, "Well, I, you know, it did it this way and I turned out just fine."
Back
it's
in
on
my
us
day.
Back in my day. Right. And I find myself saying that. And then whenever I say it, I have to say, "Well, listen, I guess that what they're saying is important because they're in a different place on the horizon. And I can use my wisdom and my clout and my age, even though it's not a lot, to be helpful to those people and and help them shape the future. We can all be a part of shaping the future. And I think it's on us to listen to what people are saying, to understand that the gratitude economy is coming, to understand that people have different values, and to be able to push forward in a way that moves us all forward. It's going to be herky jerky sometimes, not always going to be perfect. But to go back to something I said at the top, I think we're doing a good as job as we can do, and we can always strive to be better. We're never going to reach perfection, but we can always wish for something more perfect. And that is important.
I love what you're saying there about how we can support the next generation. And I mean, you're 30, so the next generation to you is 18, 19, 20. And I want to point people to an amazing article, an interview that I just did with the University of Maryland's Do Good Institute. I just got goosebumps referring you to that. Listen to that, folks, if you don't have confidence in the Gen Z, the generation that would be college age now. The University of Maryland is pretty much turning their campus and their curriculum over to the youthful aspirations for goodness and progress of that generation. The Do Good Institute on the University of Maryland is now becoming a part of almost every department, and they are one of the very first stops on the campus tour. If you're going there with your kids, man, you guys, one of you guys would have gone to the University of Maryland had they had that back when you guys were in college. But it's episode 157. And if you want to have some confidence in the future, listen to that episode with two representatives on that campus, and you will know that the future has some incredible potential in it.
Can I just add one more thing?
Yeah,
I know. Absolutely. That's really important is that youthful energy. I had the opportunity to work at Clarkson University up in upstate New York with their undergraduates. And my goodness, it was the most inspiring thing to work with young people who weren't jaded yet. Now, I was only like 5 years older than most of these students. I think they thought I was a full-blown adult. I definitely wasn't. But they had so much more energy. They weren't jaded yet. And I think we have a tendency sometimes as older people to be like, we tried that. It didn't work, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? There's a whole generation of people that have a heck of a lot of energy. And if we can push that energy in the right direction, if we can mentor that energy to the right place, we ourselves don't have to have that energy, right? We don't have to make it hard for them. We can be supportive. You know, that's like saying, I don't want to put gas in my truck because it has a low tank. No, they can be the gas in our truck. I know that we maybe don't want to be using gas in our trucks any longer, but what I'm saying is they can be the energy that fuels these ideas that we have, not in an exploitative way, but rather in a way that they still have the energy, and it's on us to help orchestrate that energy into wonderful things for the future.
You know, it might be great and helpful here for us to talk a little bit, Liesl, about how we've learned to work together all these years coming from two such wildly different generations. Mm. Folks, if you work with people that are, you know, 30 years difference in age or 40, and we all are starting to do that. I guess somebody did some research about how this is the most multi-generational workforce in the history of the world. You've got people in their 70s, clearly deep into the baby boom generation, all the way through Gen X, which is the latchkey kids, all the way through Liesl's millennial generation, and now down to the Gen Z. And Liesl and I, we're mother-daughter, so we have our days. But we've done perfectly well because we both appreciated and understood the big picture on what we're doing. And I want to share it with people. So I look at my role in the Goodness Exchange and Liesl's role like this. I imagine a big globe, a big giant earth in space turning towards me, rolling towards me very slowly. And I'm out in space about 60,000 miles, and I can see the whole picture because I've lived 63 years. But Liesl and our staff, our whole team, are right perched on the edge. They can peek over, and as the earth turns, they can see what's coming. I have no earthly idea of what's coming. I can't see it. I'm way out here. So as the earth turns, they keep walking forward because that's what they're doing now in their lives. They're doing a lot of walking forward, and they keep peering over, and they can look back at me and tell me what's coming. And then I can offer my wisdom of experience from this long life and this big picture view that I have. Now, here's the rub. I have to be able to hear what they say is coming when they're looking over at it and say, I guess I got nothing. I have to be able to say that what I think or how I want it to go back to some other way is not relevant to what's coming. Mm. And they have to also look back and say, what do you think, Mom? And maybe I will have had some life experience that casts a light on how we react to what's coming. But it's this give and take where all generations realize that the lived experience of others imparts kind of wisdom on how we deal with what's happening now. Mm. Do you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, I think one thing that I think will tie in everything we've talked about, in order to have that humility, in order to say, oh, I don't think I'm right, you cannot be afraid. And you cannot take everything that you believe to be absolute truth, right? And so in order to do that, you really have to have a positive worldview. You right. cannot, if you are dealing from a place of fear, yes. you're not listening. If you are dealing from a place of ego, you can't listen. And I think right. there's something to seeing the world in positive light, in having a sense of optimism and dealing from a space of, this is a kind of a woo-woo thing, but from a space of abundance, instead of like trying to hoard all of your resources, which is a hard thing. It's a habit we humans have to break. But if you're hoarding your resources and you're working out of fear and you are not willing to laugh at yourself or say, oh, I could be wrong in this way of thinking, and not be able to say, hey, you, based on your lived experience, I believe you, then you're going to have a hard time either way, either as a young person or as an older person, moving forward together. And so I think that's a huge thing, is us all recognizing that we have different learning lived experiences, A, and that B, we have to recognize and have some humility and a more positive worldview in order to be able to sort of progress forward together and not be working in a place of fear.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, Liesl, thank you so much for chatting with me today. We're going to try and do this once a quarter from now on in 2024. There's all this change and wonder that's happening around us, and we want to bring it to the podcast and make sure people can tap into that at least once a quarter. Thank you so much. I hope the optimism and sense of peace of mind and the sense of possibility that Liesl and I have brought to this conversation will put a spring in your step and give you some new, fresh ways of handling what's coming at you, and enjoy the conspiracy of goodness. Thank you so much.